Welcome to Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Under the Sun is a program that tells the stories of South Florida, people talking about their lives and the place where we live.
These are some of the voices you'll hear over the next hour.
They don't fall apart, my cues, because with me is no fooling around business.
Showing off is something that males do. All kinds of males, and it's certainly true in birds.
But there's a lot of crazy people here today. We were nonviolent, but they don't know that.
I said, well, I'll try to sell Miracle Fruit to everybody that likes to drink Gatorade.
What? Who's going to listen to that?
We'll hear about a tomato picker who fought to send his family in Mexico a few cents more.
A woman's quest to end youth violence.
And a fruit that makes lemonade out of lemons. This is the first episode of Under the Sun.
One of our inspirations for the show is radio producer David Isay. He created StoryCorps, everyday people talking about their lives. You may have heard it on NPR's Morning Edition.
Recently, David stopped by our studios here at WLRN. This is what he said about why we need these stories.
There's something about the human voice, just the human voice, where you can't really hide. So I think the power of stories is enormous. And I think that what we see with StoryCorps and what you're going to hear on this program is that no matter where you come from, when you hear a story of someone who may be very, very different than you, just for a moment, you're going to walk in the footsteps of that person. And that act of walking in someone's footsteps can build really powerful bridges between people and can remind people how much more we share in common than divides us.
Our first story puts you in the shoes of a low-wage migrant worker who decided to take on a corporate giant. We send Under the Sun's Ruth Morris into the tomato fields of South Florida to find out more.
Norberto Jimenez walks up to a payphone in Immokalee, a dusty migrant town 2 hours west of Fort Lauderdale. Ranchero music plays in a corner supermarket. Norberto calls Mexico, where his wife and five kids live. His teenage son, Martin, picks up. They haven't seen each other in 4 years.
¿Y tu mami?
As a boy, Norberto quit school to help his father in the fields. He didn't want the same fate for his children, but he couldn't make ends meet on his small coffee and cacao farm in Oaxaca. So he trekked across the border and came here to Immokalee to pick tomatoes. Norberto was already in his 50s when he arrived, older and slower than most pickers. He made just $50 a day and sent half of it to his family. Norberto lives simply. He shares a trailer with up to 10 other men. There's a table, 2 refrigerators, and lots of beds.
Vivo aquí. Duermo aquí.
I live here. This is where I sleep. I have to arrange my clothes on top of my bed because there is no place to put them. Now the heat is starting, and it will be very hot. We don't have air conditioning, just fans.
One day, Norberto heard from other harvesters about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group that fights for farm worker rights. He started attending coalition rallies like this one.
Este gigante en algún punto va a caer.
There can be no doubt that this giant will sooner or later fall.
I hate giants.
The giant in this case is the king, Burger King. The coalition wanted Burger King to pay an extra penny for every pound of tomatoes bought in Florida. If all buyers agreed, that little penny would nearly double wages. Gerardo Reyes is a coalition organizer.
Right now, the power of the big buyers of the tomatoes define the way that thousands of workers have to live. Because when they demand the lowest possible price, what we face are conditions of stagnant wages.
The coalition had already convinced McDonald's and Taco Bell to pay the extra penny.
We're going to try to push the domino effect. We know it's going to happen because if you move the biggest, then the rest is going to have to follow.
Miami-based Burger King is the second largest hamburger chain in the world, with revenue last year of $2.2 billion. An extra penny per pound of tomatoes would cost $250,000 a year, but the company dug in its heels. It said it was several degrees removed from the harvesters, and it needed to be sure the extra money went to farm workers. Burger King spokesman Kiva Silversmith explained the company's position to the public radio show Marketplace.
And there are all kinds of technical issues that are involved, payroll taxes, the checking of immigration status, the employment status of paying workers in a different industry who are previously not your employees, and Burger King at this point does not have a way to pass this money.
Burger King CEO John Chidsey said some farm workers are paid more in an hour than many Burger King restaurant employees. Blog posts and emails attacking the coalition began to circulate. McDonald's and Taco Bell put their penny premium in escrow until the dispute could be resolved. Suddenly, the coalition's landmark wage gains were in jeopardy. The coalition marched on Burger King headquarters last April. 300 people, including students and church leaders, joined in.
The coalition of Immokalee workers and their friends will not be stopped.
That same week, a revelation. The Fort Myers News Press reported that Burger King Vice President Stephen Grover had been the one smearing the coalition on the internet. He used his daughter's email address for cover. Burger King did an about-face. CEO Chidsey apologized in a letter for negative statements about the coalition, and he fired two unidentified employees for misconduct. In May, the company called a press conference.
Burger King is pleased to now be working together to improve the lives and wages of Florida farm workers who harvest tomatoes for the Burger King system.
Senior Vice President Amy Wagner said Burger King would pay the extra penny per pound. It would even reimburse growers for extra payroll taxes and administrative costs. Labor analyst Bruce Nissen is with Florida International University. He says the coalition has mastered that ancient art of letting your opponents dig their own grave.
It's been described at various times as using sort of jujitsu, using the power that your opponent actually does have. And in this case, it's Burger King or McDonald's. And you throw them on the basis of their own power and their own weight. They make themselves vulnerable by the way that they behave.
Back in Immokalee, the harvest is starting up again. Farm workers line up for tacos after work. Their hands are stained dark green with tomato juice. Another domino has fallen. The Subway sandwich chain has also agreed to pay harvesters an extra penny per pound. But the Immokalee workers still aren't getting the penny. Florida growers refuse to pass through the wage increase. The Florida Tomato Growers Exchange says the penny could expose them to lawsuits. Norberto left this fight to younger men. He returned home to Oaxaca.
Bueno.
Hola, buenas noches, con Norberto.
Sí, permítame.
While wages in Immokalee have not yet changed, Norberto says something has changed in him.
Una mini gira que se hizo Denver, Colorado.
I never thought there would be a way to address your rights as a worker. I thought as an immigrant, one had to be submissive toward the bosses and the growers. But through the coalition, I discovered we have the right to defend ourselves.
Norberto now spends his days harvesting coffee on his small plot. Unlike his father, he goes into the fields alone. His three oldest children were the first in the family to graduate high school. As he bends over his coffee bushes, his youngest children are in class.
Adios, paisano!
For Under the Sun, I'm Ruth Morris.
En Veracruz, pase por Puebla, por favor, baja.
It's Under the Sun. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. You know, after listening to this piece, I was a little bit confused about why the Growers Exchange was concerned about lawsuits. So I called up Reggie Brown, who is the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange Executive Vice President. And what he explained to me is that there's no way for the exchange to know who picked which tomatoes. And so by funneling the funds through the exchange opens itself up to fraud. So in other words, if one picker claims they picked X number of tomatoes and they didn't, and that's later found out, The way Mr. Brown explained it is that somebody from the exchange could actually go to jail, and they're not willing to open themselves up to that.
Did he have an alternative, a better approach?
He suggested a storefront situation whereby workers could just show how many pounds of tomatoes they picked in any given time period and get the extra funds that way, which sounds a little onerous to me, actually. But he says there has been no direct communication between the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and the Florida Growers Exchange.
You know, one thing that Reggie Brown probably didn't talk to you about is that Florida growers feel threatened by this extra penny per pound. And the reason why is because it makes Florida tomatoes more expensive. And right now they are struggling against cheaper Mexican tomatoes. And frankly, the last thing they need or want is a more expensive Florida tomato. There are practical solutions to this that they frankly aren't pursuing.
So in other words, there's a happy medium that just has not been arrived at yet.
Sure. I think that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is an organization that has very high ideals and lofty goals for bettering immigrant working conditions. And I think that they see the penny per pound campaign as a great way to get their name and their cause out there. And in some ways, it's a battle they too want to see continue. If they use the kind of creativity that they used to fight for the penny per pound increase towards finding a solution to this, I'm sure that they could find one.
Well, this is obviously a multi-layered situation that is going to continue to unfold.
You can see photos from Immokalee on our website, WLRNunderthesun.org.
It's Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch.
The writer Somerset Maugham called Florida a sunny place for shady people. A couple of decades before Bernie Madoff hit Palm Beach, a pair of cat burglars made their way up and down the coast. Manalapan, Juneau Beach, Hobe Sound. Under the Sun's Lynn Milner tells us where they are now.
Well, you have to go a little, I guess, slower for me. You know why?
Oh.
Ever since I had pneumonia, I can get out of breath quick.
Oh, okay.
It's a Saturday morning on Juneau Beach, and I'm walking with Dominic Latella. We're trying to find the DuPont Mansion. It's really hot. We have to walk about a mile, and he's wearing long pants and a polyester shirt.
This is it. This is it.
This isn't the first time Dominic's been to the DuPont Mansion. Back in 1973, he and his partner, Pete Salerno, robbed the place. They were known as the Dinner Set Gang because they usually struck while people were home eating dinner. They knew that women almost never wear their jewels at home. Plus, defenses are down. And so is the alarm system.
Hmm. Oh, what a beautiful memory.
We're hidden by tall sea oats, but Dominic's nervous that someone will see us. We climb a short set of stairs to get a good look at the house. It's one story, cream-colored, brown shingle roof. On that night, 35 years ago, Dominic and Pete came by boat, a Zodiac with a souped-up engine. Dominic was the lookout guy. He shows me where he stood so that he could see both the bedroom and the dining room. The plan was that he would whistle if he saw someone leaving the dining room table. He tries to do that whistle now, but it's hard because he's missing some teeth.
A little out of the net.
Pete is the one who would go in. He wasn't with us for the walk on the beach, but he remembers that it was dark out. The dining room was lit up. He saw a woman inside.
Her hair was light. She was elegant looking. She was lighting the candles on the table. You lighten the candles, you're going to have dinner.
At the time, they didn't know the woman was an heir to the DuPont fortune. Pete made his way along the side of the house until he got to the balcony of the master bedroom. He had his pry bar ready, but when he tried the door, it was unlocked. He pulled his ski mask over his face, walked in, and began counting to himself.
101, 102, 103.
Pete never stayed in a house longer than 3 minutes. He closed the bedroom door, locked it, and propped a chair under the knob. He held a pen light in his mouth. In the bathroom, on the counter, there was a pair of diamond earrings. He slipped them into his pocket. He didn't carry a weapon, he says, just a small knife for cutting wood and window screens. He moved to the linen closet.
And I squeezed the sheets, and it was hard. So I flipped over the sheets, and here was this big leather traveling case.
When he saw what was inside the case, he knew it was time to go. He signaled Dominic. Pete dropped the case into Dominic's hands. Then Pete put back the diamond earrings so the couple wouldn't notice right away that anything was missing. He unblocked the bedroom door and left the way he came. I talked to Pete in jail. He was doing time in Miami. But not for burglary. He got 7 years for distributing OxyContin. A doctor prescribed it after he fell off a building during a burglary attempt. Pete's sitting across from me. He's almost 70 years old. He's wearing a jumpsuit with his name sewn into it. And his last name is misspelled as Salermo with an M instead of an N.
Do you have any regrets about what you did?
No. I don't. The people I went after weren't ordinary people or working people. I mean, these were the super wealthy. You can't hurt them.
Pete's talking about the Flaglers, the Macy's, the Gembles, the Vanderbilts, the Pillsbury's. He says he got high from stealing jewels. He became an expert on the ultra-rich. He researched them at the library.
You look up who's who in America, all right? And then you just take the names.
That night at the DuPont mansion, Pete and Dominic stole $12 million worth of jewels. That's $12 million in 1973 money. The most valuable piece was a pink Tiffany diamond worth $1.8 million. Dominic says the jewels were so big, he didn't think they were real.
She had an emerald. Blade green Colombian emerald. Flawless. There were two sapphires. A 25 carat and a 22 carat. They're like searchlights. She had a thing of pearls, and the clasp was a 5 or 6 carat canary yellow marquee as the clasp.
Police never proved that Pete and Dominic did the burglary. The two say they stole $150 million in jewels during their career together, but the money's gone to middlemen, family, fancy restaurants, Cadillacs. These days, the most valuable thing Pete and Dominic have is their story. They hope to get a book or a movie deal. They even have a PR guy. But now Dominic's in debt. He's several months behind on his parole payments to the state. He drives a dented Cadillac from the 80s. He and his wife Sandra are separated. He knows his life would be different if he hadn't become a jewel thief.
If I had a normal job, I'd probably be happier. Peace of mind. I have a pension. Wouldn't have to worry.
Dominic says he grew up as a normal kid from a hardworking family in Harrison, New York. In his 20s, he was in a rock band called 2 Plus 2. They had gigs at good clubs in New York. They made a record. Then, in 1966, Dominic came to Florida to visit his parents. He met Pete.
He had arms like 21-inch guns. Very intimidating to look at him, really.
Pete brought Dominic into the business. I asked Dominic whether he regrets having been a thief.
Yes and no. I know how my wife would feel if we were in our house and finds out later someone was in a bedroom. But you don't know if that person was in it could have killed you or what have you, because there's a lot of crazy people here today. We were nonviolent, but they don't know that.
At the old DuPont house in Juneau Beach, we're able to walk almost into the backyard. We're pretty sure no one's home. Dominic points to the bedroom where Pete dropped the bag of jewels down to him 35 years ago.
He came out. He said, here, don't drop it. You're about to be a millionaire.
They stole jewels for another decade. They both did some jail time in the 80s. Dominic for theft, Pete for burglary. And after that, they gave up stealing. But in 1991, Pete's wife got cancer. He needed money for her medical bills. Once again, he roped Dominic in. They went on a tear up north. Police dogs found them hiding in the woods in Connecticut near the mansion they'd just hit. They went to jail, served their time. Pete's wife recovered. Now, 16 years later, Dominic and I sit at a picnic table in a park on Juneau Beach. The bushes are full of crickets. I ask him to play a song from his old band. He picks Waitin' for My Baby.
Right. Here it goes. Here am I. So all alone, yes, all alone by the telephone. I'm just waiting
for my baby to come on home. Right across the street, they're dining and dancing. The whole place is filled with romancing, but I'm just waiting for my baby to come.
That song's from the record his band made before the detour, as he calls it.
That was my love, and I changed from music to right here, where we took a walk. Matter of choice. It's a crazy choice, you know, when I think about it. Wow.
For Under the Sun, I'm Lynn Milner.
Baby, I bought you diamond rings. Baby, I gave you silken things. Baby, why did you do me like you did?
That's actually Dominic Latella's band, 2 Plus 2. That's the record he put out in the 60s, and it's really good.
It does sound good. It kind of makes me wonder what would have happened if he had chosen that other path. You know, the guy made one bad choice and seems to regret it.
Well, it sounds like a series of bad choices, but it all sort of came to a head in that moment when he just came down to Florida to visit his parents, as far as we know, innocently, and met Pete with the 21-inch guns.
You know, Pete clearly has no regrets, but, you know, Dominic just kind of got roped in.
Pete actually just got out of jail, and he and Dominic both say that ideally they would like to leave Florida, that it's too crazy here. They actually told Lynn, the reporter, that there's too much violent crime in Florida.
Gosh.
And of course they say that, you know, again and again say that they were not violent criminals.
Right. These guys say they stole $150 million in jewels over the course of their career, and yet they end up penniless, actually in debt. How did that happen?
Well, you know, as you heard, there were these middlemen that get some of the money. And then, you know, they had this other side business, which was a steel business. That's S-T-E-E-L. And they sunk a lot of money into that. Mm-hmm. And also, these are guys who really liked to live high on the hog.
Right.
So they just spent a lot of money. They stole a lot of money and they spent a lot of money.
You're listening to Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. We're telling the stories of South Florida. A little while ago, I heard about this thing called miracle fruit. For $3 a pop, it totally transforms your taste buds for about 2 hours. I'll tell you more in a minute. It's from a tree originally grown in West Africa, but it turns out the grower who ships these berries across the country is here in Fort Lauderdale. He's a guy named Curtis Mosey. He calls himself the Miracle Fruit Man. I had to meet him.
Everything you see from here back is all miracle fruit trees.
So we are at Bioplants Farm, Curtis Mosey. How did you get to be the Miracle Fruit Man?
When I was a young boy, we used to buy a hog plum, H-O-G-P-L-U-M. 50 years later, I wanted me a hog plum tree. I drove out to Davie. I walked to the nursery and asked the lady, I said, do you have a hog plum tree? So she said, do you know what type of tree this is? This is a miracle fruit tree. So I took a miracle fruit, picked a lemon, and when I tasted fruit, that's all it took. I knew exactly what I was going to do from that point. I basically was just growing the trees in my backyard. I started asking questions about the miracle fruit, and people would say, oh, it's just a novelty. You can't make any money off it.
People told you you couldn't make any money off miracle fruit.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And now I know that you have back orders all over the country.
Yes, that's correct. 2007, I started a new business. It was almost stupid not to.
Now, I want to go back for a second. You said that, you know, you knew in that moment, the first time that you tasted miracle fruit, what you wanted to do with your life.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Tell me more about that moment.
Well, what happened, my kids were playing Little League football, and I personally didn't like Gatorade. So I said, wow, what if kids could eat a miracle fruit and the Gatorade would taste sweeter? So they would drink more fluids. So I said, well, I'll try to sell miracle fruit to everybody that likes to drink Gatorade. So my market was worldwide.
So you're saying you thought that Gatorade was not sweet enough?
Personally, to me, Gatorade has a little bitter taste to it. And if you eat a miracle fruit, The Gatorade tastes like Kool-Aid.
Well, why don't we taste some fruit?
All right, sure will.
So you just use a regular household pair of scissors, and that's what you're going to use to cut the fruit off?
Yes, each fruit is cut with the pair of scissors. And what we do, you cut right here. That's one.
So it's just a little red berry?
Yeah. You just take the fruit, you put it in your mouth. The skin will come, usually peels right off.
Oh, yeah?
You can either eat the skin.
So should I do it now?
Yeah, don't bite the seed, okay?
Hmm.
You can do it right away. Now try to remove everything off the seed.
When you send these out, do you send instructions?
Not right. No, I don't. I should send instructions, but it's almost like painting with an ounce of paint. You can't paint a whole house. So you have very little fruit trying to cover your sour taste buds.
I see. Hmm? That's the point. Okay, I got it.
There's a chemical in there called miraculin.
Miraculin is the name of the chemical?
Yeah.
So about how long does it take to kick in?
Is it in right now? Try your lemon first.
I'm going to try a lemon, okay. It tastes like an orange. It tastes like an orange. It's definitely citrus, but it's much sweeter than normal citrus is.
Yeah. Now, if you had just some lemon juice and water, you have perfect lemonade.
So you eat a miracle fruit, you mix lemon juice and water, and you don't even need sugar.
That's correct. For 2 hours, if it's 10 gallons, it'll all be sweet.
Well, I brought some foods that I really don't like, olives and cilantro. So,
try your olive.
An olive, all right. It's salty. Is it supposed to be salty?
Be honest with you, I don't see any difference in taste.
Well, so now we know that olives are probably not the best complement to miracle fruit, but lemons are a standby. Lemons are always good.
Oh, yeah. It's lemons, limes, grapefruits, green bananas. In fact, I have some star fruit.
So now we're going to try star fruit that's not quite ripe.
All right, correct.
That's the point, right?
Yes.
Mmm, that's really good. Wow, this tastes perfectly ripe to me. I can't believe that that's a green star fruit. You know what strikes me, Curtis, is this is really fun for you still, introducing people to miracle fruit.
Well, you're experiencing something, and I enjoy the look on your face. That's what I felt when I first tried the miracle fruit. It was like unreal.
Look at that. A handful of miracle fruit.
That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's $21.
$21.
That's what they meant by money grows on trees.
Well, Curtis, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for introducing me to miracle fruit.
Sure. All right. Come back anytime.
You know, Alicia, you said it costs $3 a pop for each berry. Is it worth it?
It is worth it. It's a real novelty, obviously. It's not the kind of fruit that you're going to eat every day, but it's a lot of fun for a couple of hours.
So what did you do after you left the farm?
So after I left, I went over to the grocery store and got some onions and some green peppers, even some Sour Patch Kids. And it was really amazing. I mean, I just bit into an onion like it was nothing. And the Sour Patch Kids did not taste sour. They just tasted like sweet candy. One of the other things I asked Curtis is, you know, he ships these berries all over the country, and I asked him where his biggest market is, and he said New York City. And, you know, we read this article, I don't know, going back several months now, about people having these tasting parties in New York. So, but they're getting the berries frozen. Here we can get them fresh. So.
I mean, if you go onto YouTube, which is something that we did together, and look up Miracle Fruit, you'll have these kind of amateur recordings of Brooklyn hipsters, you know, eating like the most disgusting food with relish.
Do you think it's an example of, you know, people who have too much time on their hands?
I think so. Brooklyn hipsters, clearly.
Hey, I used to be one of those.
So did my girlfriend.
That's right.
You know, it's Peter in the control room here. I want to know what kind of a farm this guy has. Is it like a big orchard?
The trees are growing on part of the farm. And they actually grow not directly in the ground, but they're all in these plastic planters.
Could you grow a miracle fruit tree in your backyard then?
I asked him that. You can actually grow one in your apartment.
No kidding.
Yeah. And apparently mockingbirds in particular really like miracle berries. So he's sort of involved in this sort of war against the mockingbirds who are picking these $3 a berry berries off the tree.
We live in Brooklyn, baby. We live in Brooklyn, baby.
Still to come on Under the Sun, an old world craftsman shoots for the perfect billiards cue on Miami Beach.
And what's up with all those blackbirds on the power lines?
We'll be right back.
We're gonna make it, baby.
We're back with Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. We're telling the stories of South Florida.
For years, billiards aficionados made a kind of pilgrimage to a place called Star Q. It was a tiny shop just off Fifth Street in South Beach, tucked behind an upscale floral boutique called Flower Bazaar. A Lithuanian Jewish woodturner made some of the country's most coveted pool cues there. Under the Sun's Tristram Corton stopped in one afternoon.
82-year-old Abe Rich works in a cramped workshop in South Beach with an address almost impossible to find. He's been handcrafting pool cues here from exotic blocks of wood for the past four decades. He says, be careful, the place is crowded.
Yeah, come here, be careful, it's a crowded place.
His shop is filled with thousands of long, narrow blocks of wood, cocobolo, ebony, and maple. Stacked floor to ceiling. Above a desk piled high with newspapers, old photos hang on the wall, along with a yellowed sign that reads, "There is no substitute for hard work." He is one of the last masters of this craft.
He makes the best. There's no describing it. It's perfect. It's all perfect.
Gary Gottfried tracked Abe down shortly after moving to Miami Beach in the 1970s.
Well, I knew of him. I knew his name. From when I was in my teens, came down here and I sought him out. 30 to 35 years ago is when I bought his cue, and it's still straight and it's still beautiful.
His cues have been bought and traded by collectors, professionals, and amateurs. Minnesota Fats and Jackie Gleason have purchased Abe Rich cues.
My name is good, thank God. I have calls almost every day.
Would you say you're famous?
In a way, yeah.
But fame isn't his goal. He is interested in just one thing, creating the perfect cue. He works alone 6 days a week, patiently crafting his cues on a wood-turning lathe he built by hand.
I'm a perfectionist by nature. Everything has to be made the right way.
Abe comes from a long line of Lithuanian Jewish woodworkers. His grandfather, father, and uncle all turned wood before him. Abe started working with his father at age 11, and the skills he learned saved his life.
Actually, to tell you the truth, I am a Holocaust survivor. They killed my father, my mother, my little brother. I survived because when it came before Christmas, you know what I mean, they was going home. The killers was going home for Christmas. And they knew that I'm a good turner. They said to me, would you make me a little chess, a riser chess, when you travel?
He made chess sets for Nazi officers. He built scaffolds in their factories.
And this is the reason why I'm talking to you now. If I wouldn't know how to work by hand, they would kill me like they killed others. But I was a useful Jew, they call it. Useful.
When American soldiers liberated Abe from Dachau concentration camp in 1944, he weighed less than 100 pounds.
Only skin and bones.
After he was freed, he moved to what was then Palestine. Then to Miami in the 1960s to work in his brother's shop, Rich Woodturning. In 1973, he opened his own shop, devoted only to pool cues.
Listen to me. I'm a walking man. They don't fall apart, my cues. It's made with good material. Because with me, it's no fooling around business.
Abe Rich never married, and he has no children.
To be fair with you, I'm from the last Mohicans. When I will be gone, you will not see shops like this. They have all modern machines. Money you cannot make the way I work. But you can satisfy people and make people happy. In the last few years, what is left for me, I want to make people happy.
For Under the Sun, I'm Tristram Corton.
It's so important to make someone happy. Make just one someone happy. Make just one heart-to-heart you. You sing to...
You know, after hearing this piece, I had to meet Abe, and you took me to his shop.
Right, and it was closed, which was really unusual. You heard in the piece that he works 6 days a week. And so we went over to the flower shop right in front of where Star Q is, and they told us that he passed away almost right after we finished producing this piece.
You know, it was weird. I felt the loss. I had wanted to meet him so badly.
The owners of the flower shop told us that people continue, even though it's closed, they keep showing up and showing up, hoping that, you know, somebody will be there to, you know, sell them some of the last cues that were produced by Abe Rich.
What do you think it is about Abe's story that has moved so many people? What do you think it is about Abe that has moved so many people?
Well, obviously, he's a survivor. He's a Holocaust survivor, but he's also a survivor on levels beyond that. I mean, he took this craft that literally saved his life, and he turned it into something that, as you heard him say, makes people happy.
What I think moves me about this piece is it's like you're hearing an old world. Just the voice, his accent, his ethic of hard work and dedication to craft above all else. He didn't get married. He had no children. And yet he does have a legacy, and that legacy is being used by people all around the world, and those are his cues.
For these billiards aficionados, it's like it's an honor to own an Abe Rich pool cue. And that's it. There are no more now.
It's like a piece of history.
You're listening to Under the Sun. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. You can find us online at WLRNunderthesun.org. In our next piece, we explore the ways people in South Florida make a living. It's our regular segment called All in a Day's Work. Highlay is a sport that comes from the Basque regions of Spain and France. In the 60s and 70s, the game drew huge crowds and glamorous stars. Now, there are just 5 places left to watch highlay in the United States, and they're all in Florida. Today, we take you to one of the oldest, Dania Highlay.
My name is Ryan Esdale. I'm 17 years old, and I'm an announcer at Dania Highlay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Dania Highlay. The players salute you for Game 1, a spectacular 7 doubles match, serving in the red shirts of Post 1. Medrano,
I'm responsible for first calling the judges in to let them know the game was about to begin. Then I start the music, which brings out the players. Highlay is a sport that's similar to racquetball in the sense that you're returning a ball to your opponent. If you don't return it, you lose the point. The cesta is the tool we use as highlay players to throw the pelota. Pelota is the ball used in the sport of highlay. This here is a piece of bulletproof glass shattered by a pelota, moving probably around 180 miles an hour. That was the fastest it's ever been clocked. Here at Dania, all the games that are played with the audience watching are all being bet on.
Mm-hmm. 1-4, 1-4, let's see. That's it.
I put this noise on, which is the final call for betting. When the announcer talks too much, you might hear a remark in the crowd, like, be quiet, announcer, or maybe a little, they say it a little more rudely, but I won't say it.
It's time to give up, man.
He's playing well, man. All right. Don't worry.
He's not interested.
When I first started coming to highlay, there used to be a
height restriction on what you have to be to come in here, and I didn't meet that requirement. So my parents would sometimes stuff my shoes with napkins or fluff my hair to make me tall enough to reach that little blue line that got you the permission to get in here. My favorite benefit of working at Dania Highlight is the privilege of playing on the court. When I decided to become pro, I was about 12 or 13. My dad had a contract to play in Palm Beach Highlight back when they were open, and they happened to close right when he got the contract, so he didn't get to play. So I'm sure if I got to play at Dania, that would somehow fulfill something that he would want to do. He'd be proud of me for that.
How did I meet you? Did you just come over and sit down, or?
I don't even know.
I don't remember. You know, it's probably the same way I meet everybody. I mean, we have so many friends here. They're like, here's my friend Lisa coming right now. Lisa and her husband Steve. And Jake and Max and them I know. And there's Ginny and her husband Bob. And
the capacity of the stands is approximately 3,000 people. This is a Saturday afternoon, and it looks like we have approximately 100 people or so out in the audience for today. This is an average crowd for a Saturday matinee. It is kind of depressing to see how the capacity used to be so large and it's gone down so much. There's got to be a reason for that. And I wish it was back the way it used to be, where every seat was filled.
That piece was produced by Under the Sun's Trina Sargalski.
Dan, what's that noise at the end?
That's the sound of a highlai pelota kind of fading into the night.
Oh, that's so sad.
I know. This is a sad piece. Ryan is following a line that was passed from his father, and I don't know if this sport's going to survive.
And it really is such a Floridian treasure.
It's amazing to me to think that this thing used to be a sport of rock stars. You know, the people who played this game were stopped in the street. And today, basically, it's a place for people to go and gamble. People don't really care about the sport. It's an anachronism. Most Americans have no idea what highlai is.
So you think the people that are there in the stadiums don't care about the sport?
I think they do, but I think it's frankly a little more incidental to the fact that they're probably like to gamble. maybe that's actually a little uncharitable. I do think that if there weren't a gambling element to the sport, I don't think it would even have survived this long. You may have heard of Queen Brown. Her son was killed 2 years ago. She's pushed for an end to youth violence ever since. In speeches and on the radio, Queen talks about the wrenching experience of losing her son. But the fallout of his death affects her in ways she never expected. Under the Sun's Kenny Malone has the story.
A steady drizzle falls in Dade Memorial Park. A woman kneels at her son's grave, a simple marble slab with a bronze plaque. Etched into the plaque is the helmet from her son's high school football team.
He was on the Vikings football team with Miami Norland. Up in the right-hand corner is his football helmet. He was number 58.
The woman's name is Queen Brown. Her 24-year-old son, Everton, was a football star. 2 years ago, he was killed in a drive-by shooting. Everton's death transformed Queen. She's become one of Miami's most powerful voices for ending youth violence. His death fuels her speeches, drives her outreach, inspires her to fight on. Queen visits her son's grave once a week.
I didn't see my son after he was shot. And that was one of the biggest regrets. Sometimes you ride and you see a roadkill, and I figure my son died like a roadkill. He died on the streets like a lot of our children. These are children. They're not dying at home. They're not dying in a bed. They're dying on the streets like animals.
Queen has told the story of Everton's death and its aftermath to grieving parents, at community rallies, on CNN. What she doesn't share is that for months after the murder, she blamed her sister, Tina, for Everton's death. While she pleaded publicly for an end to youth violence, she saw its cause in her own family.
It's certain things about this whole event that really just tears me apart, and I think it will always tear me apart for the rest of my life.
Queen Brown lives in Miami Gardens, a city in northwest Miami-Dade. FBI crime statistics rank Miami Gardens as the 13th most dangerous city in the nation. Queen raised 4 kids here as a single mother. She fought her way off food stamps by getting a job as a Miami-Dade parking attendant. She put her three oldest kids through college. But Queen struggled with Everton, her youngest. By age 22, he'd been arrested four times. In 2001, he pled guilty to attempted armed robbery and was given 3 years probation. Everton's best hope was football. He won a scholarship to be a linebacker at Florida A&M in Tallahassee. Then, during his sophomore year, Everton got his longtime girlfriend pregnant. He dropped out of school and moved back to Miami Gardens to be closer to his girlfriend and their daughter. Queen was devastated. She had worked two decades to get Everton out of the slums. Now, he was coming back.
I begged him to stay in school. I told him, you need an education to get a job. You can't get a decent paying job without your education. I went through that whole spiel. It didn't work.
Everton worked nights driving dump trucks. Before his shift on October 26, 2006, Everton went for a drive with his cousin Josh, Tina's son. A few hours passed and the boys didn't come home. They weren't answering their cell phones. Queen and her sister Tina got worried. They drove around the neighborhood in search of their sons. The radio was on.
And there was some special news break that there was a car had been shot. And when they said a white Ford, two people in a car, one shot fatally, my sister immediately began to scream.
The sisters sped to the intersection of North Miami Avenue and 156th Street. The crime scene had already been cleared. They called the police station and the hospital, but couldn't find out which son was killed. So the sisters went home and waited.
We sat there for hours, all of us, the entire family, and we did not know whose child it was. They would come to me, and they'd be like, oh, I hope it's not Everton. Then they go to her, and oh, I hope it's not Joshua. And it had to be one of our sons.
Finally, a police officer knocked on the door. He said a car had pulled up alongside Josh's white Ford and opened fire. Everton was shot through the lung and died on the scene. He was the 200th murder in Miami that year. His cousin Josh was fine. The officer was holding a brown paper bag with Everton's belongings. He handed the bag to Queen.
The belt was curled like a snake, and in the middle of the belt was his cell phone that was sitting on top of the wallet. The bag started vibrating, and I looked at it, and you could see the name come up in the phone, and it was Saudia, and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to tell this girl that the father of her child is dead?
It's not clear why Everton was murdered that October night. After 2 years, Miami police say the case is still under investigation. No one's been charged. But Queen is convinced the intended target was Josh. She says Josh ran with a rough crowd. Earlier that day, he'd gotten into an argument over a girl. In her speeches, Queen says the only way to end youth violence is for parents to be involved in their children's lives. She believes her own sister didn't follow that advice. Queen says Tina should have stepped in when Josh started getting into trouble. A few days after the murder, Queen confronted her little sister.
I told her she was a horrible mother, raising children that go out and do horrible things. I told her she raised a monster.
In better times, Queen relished the role of big sister. As Queen pulled herself out of poverty, she pulled Tina out too. Queen took Josh and Tina's other kids to the beach. She helped Tina finish college. But Everton's death shattered their relationship. The sisters haven't seen each other since the funeral. Tina declined to be interviewed for this story. She says the fallout of Everton's murder is too difficult to talk about. In the weeks following Everton's death, Queen channeled her anger into civic action. She called the mayors of Miami and Miami-Dade County to beg them to stop youth violence. One morning, she woke up with a big idea. She went to a local radio station.
And they're like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Queen Brown, and I got to warn the people that children are dying, and I need to get this information out. And they were like, what? Who's going to listen to that?
Hello, you're listening to the Queen Brown Show on 940 Wings.
Okay, I got a lot of callers. All my lines are lit up, so what I'm going to do is go straight to the callers.
Queen now hosts a two-hour call-in radio show on Sunday afternoons.
Well, we have Christina in Miami. Good afternoon, Christina, you're on the air.
Week after week, the show comes back to the same point. Any attempt to end youth violence must begin with the parents.
I just wanted to say, I think the most important thing we all need to remember here is that it all starts with what's going on in the home and why are these children doing this. I'm really concerned about why this is happening.
Exactly. And we're going to get to the bottom of it. And eventually one day, I'm sure, Christina, we will find out. I want to thank you so much for your call and thank you for listening to Queen Brown Show.
Sandy Moisi is the former head of the Parent Academy in Miami. She saw Queen's potential early on and began booking her as a motivational speaker around town.
Queen's message serves to let parents know that they are a critical element in preventing violence in their children's lives just by being involved, just by spending time, making sure that parents know where their children are, where they're going, who their friends are. So I think it's important to come from another parent, and especially a parent who has experienced a tragedy.
Queen regrets that she didn't force Tina to keep a closer eye on Josh, and she wants to make sure other parents don't make the same mistake. A year after Everton's death, a man named Aluyi Midankwa was murdered. Queen was a family friend and knew Aluyi since he was a boy. She was asked to speak at the funeral.
I want to do a little tribute to Aluyi, but I'm going to do it from a different perspective. Because I've got a problem this afternoon, and that's the reason I'm here.
The problem, she said, is that parents don't want to hear her message. So she's beating down doors and demanding parents pay attention.
I know you don't usually hear this inside of a funeral, but you ain't going to listen to me on my radio show. You ain't going to call in and talk about violence. You're not going to pick up the paper. You're not going to go into the classroom and sit down and study what's the impact, what's happening in our community. So if you won't come to me, I'm coming to you. I want to talk to you about what's happening in our community. We got to stop the madness.
Queen believes she was born to deliver this message. Her full name is Queen Esther Brown. In the Bible, Queen Esther saved the Israelites from genocide.
She put her life on the line to save her people. I feel the same way.
Queen says she rose from poverty to speak in the halls of power. To remind herself why she fights, she visits Everton's grave, and she goes to Scott Park, where he learned to play football.
This is where Everton used to play ball. And see the Viking little football helmets? That's what's on his tombstone.
What do you think when you see those little kids wearing that same helmet?
I see little Evertons all over again, and I realize how much they need me to be out here doing what I'm doing. It's a world out here that's waiting to devour them if they're not careful, and I feel like I'm kind of like a protector.
Queen has spent every day for the past 2 years talking about Everton's death, but she says it wasn't until our conversations that she fully realized the toll it had taken on her own family, on her relationship with her sister. That is the double tragedy of any murder. There's the initial loss, and there are the aftershocks which can reverberate for years. Queen says there's one thing that keeps her going. Everton's daughter, her only granddaughter, Saida. Today, Saida turns 3. Queen throws her a huge birthday bash with 60 guests. She hires face painters, rents a bounce house, and a cotton candy machine.
And there's Saida on the pony. Saida's riding the pony. Saida! Hey, Grandma, big girl. Hi.
Queen says Saida is helping her become whole again.
That's my son. All over again. It's like I'm getting another chance. I'm getting a second chance. And it's wonderful. I love it. And I'm enjoying it. I'm really enjoying it.
Saida was too young to speak when Everton died. When she said the word daddy for the first time, she was speaking to Everton's grave. Sadia Ali is Saida's mother. She says Queen has been an ideal grandmother.
She's a very giving and loving person. Anything I need, call her. And not even just for Saida, for me too, you know?
Queen's sister Tina is at the party. She and Queen haven't spoken yet. But as the afternoon winds down, Tina walks up to Queen and puts a crumpled $100 bill into Queen's hand. Tina whispers into Queen's ear, then slips away.
She came over and whispered, I have something I want to give to you. And I told her, for me? She said, well, for the baby. I said, well, give it to the baby. She says, no, it's money. And then she put it in my hand. It's like she's trying to give me what I'm missing, but she can't. She's not the reason that I'm missing it. She needs to understand. She's not the reason for my loss, and she needs to understand that. But anyway, we're going to enjoy today, and I'm going to thank God because she is my present today, because we're sisters. She's my present. So this is a beginning. This is a beginning.
Queen says she no longer blames Tina for her son's death. Over those 2 long years begging for an end to youth violence, Queen came to see that Tina and Josh were victims as well. Later that afternoon, Tina and Queen reunite.
Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you. Thank you.
I was telling him how good you are with my kids, my son, my oldest son. How you mentoring, how you love me,
your favorite aunt. And likewise, I told him, all our children are close.
Yes, they are.
Yes. We're close. Mm-hmm. We're close.
I told him you always gave us positiveness. You never had nothing negative to say about nobody.
Yeah.
The bad in someone, you always made something good out of it.
Thank you, Tina.
Queen knows she faces an uphill battle. Gun deaths of black teens are on the rise nationwide. But Queen doesn't plan to fight this battle alone.
Please.
As the party wraps up, Queen steps outside with Saida. She hoists her grandbaby into her arms, tilts her head back, and sings.
Hold me, hold me.
For Under the Sun, I'm Kenny Malone.
Look at what? What's that? What's that?
It's Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch.
Up next, What's Up with South Florida, our regular segment where we invite listeners to tell us what they find confusing or unusual about South Florida. We took a poll so you could decide what we should investigate. You flocked to the birds.
Hi, this is Donna Natalie Planis of Surfside. What's up with all those blackbirds every day at dusk?
Under the Sun's Carrie McKernan found out.
No one really knows what goes on in a bird's brain. That's according to John Ogden, who heads up bird conservation for Audubon of Florida. But after years of watching blackbirds, he offers an educated guess.
When they come together as flocks, they're actually learning from each other where the food is. And so if you're a bird that's hungry, you follow a bird that seems to know where it's going.
What we do know is blackbirds nest individually or in pairs and spend lots of time defending their nests. But they're social creatures, too. When they're done nesting, blackbirds like to flock up, as Ogden puts it, especially at night. So what's up with that racket? Ogden says birds make noise for lots of reasons. To defend themselves, to keep track of one another, and of course, to impress the girls.
That's the grackle up there calling now, big male. He's here to roost tonight, but he's also showing off. So while he's still light, he's going to call and he's going to fluff his feathers and make as much noise as he can. And when other males come in, they'll all be doing it at the same time. It can be pretty noisy at times. Showing off is something that males do, all kinds of males, and it's certainly true in birds.
As for the swarms, that's about safety in numbers. The more birds, the more eyes to watch out for predators, like owls and hawks. We're watching the birds come in from the corner of 36th and Biscayne in downtown Miami. It's dusk. At first, they fly in a few at a time.
It's getting darker now. They're starting to really come in serious numbers now.
They land on high wires and building tops, all lined up in a row, evenly spaced, facing the same direction.
And that looks very much like a scene out of Alfred Hitchcock movie when they sit there in a row looking down on us, 40 birds sitting in a row.
We hear them, but we can't see them anymore unless we stand right under the tree. That's when I reveal something to John Ogden.
I have a very terrible fear of these birds. It's quite frightening for me to stand underneath this mahogany tree and hear this loud squawking of this large throng of birds. You described it as hundreds of birds hiding in this tree. I'm really afraid. I would not be standing here without the protection of an experienced ornithologist. Is this something people should actually be afraid of, or is this completely irrational of me?
It's completely irrational because these birds could care less that you're down here. They may drop something on you sooner or later, but that's about the worst they're going to do to you.
Good to know.
Now take it easy, lady. There isn't a bird anywhere in sight.
For Under the Sun, I'm Carrie McKernan.
If there's something that makes you wonder what's up with South Florida, call us at 305-995-2408 and let us know. Or you can always find us online at WLRNunderTheSun.org. And that's it for our show. You've been listening to Under the Sun on 91.3 WLRN.
Our executive producer is Peter J. Meritz. Our assistant producers are Kenny Malone and Trina Sargalski. Trina's also our web guru.
Our show is engineered by Wanda Miles, Paul Leary, and Brett Rothfeld. We had help from Carrie McKernan, Naomi Nix, Jose Maya, Robert Lyle, Asha Marate, and Tracy Fields.
And we did everything else.
A little humility, Dan.
Whatever. Special thanks to WLRN General Manager John Labonia, WLRN Projects Manager Adrian Kennedy, and Rick Lewis of Friends of WLRN.
Our theme music is by Miami's own Spam All-Stars. You can hear them every Thursday night at Hoy Como Ayer in Little Havana.
You can see photos, hear extra audio, or drop us a line at WLRNunderthesun.org.
Under the Sun is a co-production of WLRN and ZG Public Media. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch.